for me.
All right, that's all right. So the Joint Commission came out with their report back in 2017, and I thought the panel that they brought together did a really great job of evaluating what were some of the common issues that people run into and trying to provide some clear guidance on some of the biggest issues. You know, some of these things are obvious. They agreed that all inpatient areas must be ligature resistant. I think we all agree with that. They offered two exceptions: areas around the nurse station and areas behind self-closing and self-locking doors. So this is very helpful guidance. So what this means is, for example, if you have an exam room in your unit, and you probably do, that you are going to take patients into, but only under direct supervision. It's very difficult. Whatever his problem is, he gave it to me, to create a ligature-resistant exam room and have it work effectively. So the exam room should be behind a self-closing and self-locking door, right? And then you don't have to worry about that, but you have to have an operational plan that you will never leave a patient in there alone because it's not a safe space for them. The other one is areas around nurse station. This one gets muddy. What I have found is that most of the clients I have worked with have found that they are not getting relief on ligature safety for areas that are in and around the nurse station. In, yes. On, attached to, yes. But as soon as you step about a foot away from, they're generally getting cited for those. So this one seems to be one that I would say take with a grain of salt. I know everybody's a little different, but we've seen a lot of people who felt like they had an issue that was hard to resolve and was directly in front of the nurse station and still get cited for it. So I urge caution on that one. They also brought up the drop ceilings, but they provided a lot better guidance on it. So they provided more. And I think even if you're not in a Joint Commission facility, the guidance they provided is pretty useful for all of us. They also use the drop ceilings term, so I'll get off that soapbox before Dion comes over and takes my blinker away, my thingy away. What they basically said is an acoustical ceiling is acceptable in an observed area. And they gave a bunch of guidelines on what an observed area would look like. And I pretty much agreed with them on that, and then they added one other caveat that muddies the whole thing. Unless there's any movable furniture, equipment, or anything that a patient could remove to an area and stand on, even in an observed area. So if you have a single piece of movable furniture, you've invalidated this rule. The simple answer to this in most cases is to put in an ACT ceiling and use a clip-down system so that you know that it is secure. Now, what that means is if you have to do maintenance above the ceiling, you need to bring new ceiling tiles with you because every time you try... I know you're supposed to be able to get them out, but the reality is you break the ceiling tile when you take those out. Most people do. That's a pretty worthwhile sacrifice in order to have the acoustical treatment we need in that space. Warning, though, I have seen some examples of surveyors who have felt that that was not adequate and that if a patient could punch through the tile, it still wasn't safe. That's mostly been able to be appealed and worked through. I think that's just people working through, and I think that's going to settle out in the industry on its own over some time. Another one has to do with medical beds. I'm always surprised how many psychiatric inpatient units I see that use medical beds when not that many of the patients in them really do need the medical beds. So the simple version of this rule is, as I understand it, you're going to be okay with a medical bed in the room under two circumstances. Number one, the doctor has actually made it put in an order that that patient needs to be in that medical bed. There are psychiatric medical beds, but they're still not as safe as the platform beds you typically see in these bedrooms. And so number one, you need to have a doctor's order. You can't just say, well, we just want them available in case patients need them. That's not really a good answer. And number two, you need to have a mitigation plan. You need to acknowledge that there's a risk in the room and that you have some mitigation plan. You've done a suicide risk assessment on the patient. You have... the doctor has given some direct orders on how they want you to handle this patient, and you have a plan in place. And if you're doing those two things, then it's a pretty reasonable thing to do, and you should be okay. But I don't think you want to have somebody come in and find one of those psychiatric medical beds in one of your inpatient unit rooms, and you don't have anything in the record saying that you needed it there. So doing the paperwork on that is really important. And then my very favorite thing that came out of this, because this has been a pet peeve for me, and it has a major impact on one of the other things y'all are responsible for, which is your survey scores, right? So one of the things they found is a lot of people had been moving away from the idea of a hinged toilet seat, a traditional residential style toilet seat on toilets, believing, reasonably speaking, that it appears to be a ligature hazard, right? What this commission found was that there were literally tens of thousands of toilets with those toilet seats installed in inpatient facilities around the country, and they couldn't find any evidence of it, of them being actually used as ligature points. And so they decided that statistically speaking, it was better to save. And the reason this was a big deal is because when surveyed, when patients give negative surveys coming out of facilities that don't have that, the lack of a dignified way of using the toilet is one of the number one complaints patients have. So if we can give them a proper, dignified toilet to sit on, as we would all want, and it's not going to create a safety problem, let's do that, okay? So I'll show you some examples when we get to the pictures of some how that might look, but I really, really appreciated that they made the effort for that, because I think that's a big part of, after the ceiling thing, it's one of my big pet peeves about treating patients with dignity and respect and creating a therapeutic environment for them. The 2019 HC04 from DMVGL, it has a couple of interesting tidbits in it. I'm going to get to one in a minute. But for the most part, what it says is, we're here to enforce CMS's guidelines, and you should follow them, and that's what we're going to enforce. They didn't layer on another layer of information. It's not good or bad. It's just worth knowing if you're a DMV facility that they did not layer on a lot of other information. So Joint Commission, in their National Patient Safety Goals 150101, EP1 says the organization conducts an environmental risk assessment. Now, you remember back earlier I mentioned that CMS said you don't have to do that, but indicated that it's a good idea to do that and even suggested a standard for how you might do that, right? Well, Joint Commission says you do have to do that. So if you look at the CMS thing and say, well, I don't have to do it, it's just nice, no. If you're in Joint Commission facility, you do have to do it. It's very clearly stated. They're going to look for it. And if you're thinking, well, I'm DMV, I don't have to do it, one of the things that was in that memo was a reference to their guide to inspection teams, which specifically says, ask the ward manager to show you a copy of the last ligature audit, which is another way of saying you do have to have an environmental risk assessment available. So whatever facility you are, aside from the fact that it's really good practice. And so for the next little part of the presentation, I want to talk a little bit about what that is. But let me just ask those of you who raised your hands, because you're healthcare engineers and you have inpatient facilities, how many of you are certain you have one of these on file ready to show an inspector when they come in? How many of you are not, if you want to raise your hands and admit that? Okay. So we'll talk a little bit about what should be in them and what's helpful. There is not, to my knowledge, clear guidance that says thou shalt have chapter 1, chapter 2, chapter 3. It's just that you must have done it and be prepared to show them. So I'm going to talk to you about some things that we have seen be successful. And we get to the Q&A. You guys can come back at me with things you've seen be successful that maybe I haven't seen yet. We'll get the right answer for everybody. So in my experience, there are basically five elements that you need to have in your environmental risk assessment in order to convey to a surveyor a level of trust that you are on it and you are doing your job and that the space is safe and is being regularly and properly evaluated. The first is a summary. Whenever the last time you did it, write up a summary. Whether it's if you have someone like me come in and do it for you, it'd be a letter. If you do it internally, it's a memo. But write up a summary, put it on the first page so that it's like an executive summary on a big report. As of today, this is what you should know about this facility. This is all the stuff we fixed. This is when we last fixed it. This is when we last checked it. These are the things that are problems because the facility is old and it's not ideally laid out. And so we have done this, this, and this about them. More information in the following chapters, right? If I'm a surveyor and I show up, that's the first thing I want to see, right? Give me the executive summary. What have you done before I have to dig into all this and find out? The second thing is a checklist. Whether you prefer the ASHI checklist or whether you prefer the VA checklist, whether you want to create your own checklist, whether you have something else. There's no rule that says you have to use one or the other. CMS doesn't recommend, mentions one. Joint Commission does recommend one, which is the ASHI one. They're both good. they're not actually that different in terms of content. It's really more formatting. I think you're fine with either one. I think you're fine with something else as long as it covers all the same things, right? Don't think you have to feel like, but if someone's gone to the trouble of creating a tool for you, it's not a bad idea to go ahead and use the tool. This is something that I don't see a lot of, but I strongly recommend. This is what I call a diagram of space types. And so what you do is you just take the floor plan of the space, and in this case, we've divided it into three colors. So red is spaces in which patients can be alone. This is your highest level of ligature safety. These are going to have the hard ceilings and secure everything. And then orange is the spaces where patients congregate, recreate, are generally observed. They're with each other. They're with staff. It's a lower level of risk, but you don't lower it by much. You still want a ligature-resistant space. You still want psych safety in all the various ways. There are a few things we back off on. In particular, we don't push for the hard ceilings. You can do a few other things with some diffusers and lights, and so there's a little bit more flexibility that can be had in those spaces. And then yellow are the spaces that patients either don't go into or only go into under direct supervision. These are the spaces that are separated by self-locking, self-closing door. If I'm a surveyor and I come into your space and you hand me that and I can walk around your space and look at that, it's really easy for me to say, hey, I see ligature risk in this room. Oh, it's yellow. Okay, we're good. I got a self-closing, self-locking door. I agree that this is appropriate to be a yellow space. Move on. It saves some discussion later. It just makes everybody's job easier. You appreciate it. They appreciate it. The next one that not everybody does is a report of corrective actions. Don't hide the fact that you found something and you fixed it. Tell them. Put in a full report of everything that you did. Go ahead and show them. This is all the stuff that we, 6 months ago, we surveyed the facility. We found all these things. This is what we did to fix them. That was done on these dates. Here's where you go. Here's the pictures. You can see the before. You can see the after. And they can see that you're taking your process seriously and that they know that it's not just it's always been this way and you're just defending it. When you see a problem, you fix a problem. You all are doing that anyway. It's just a matter of showing it. And then the last one is mitigation protocols. Unless you have a brand new facility or a badly designed brand new facility, in the older facilities, you're going to run into something that just can't be made perfect. And it's an evaluation of all the risks associated with it and what is the right combination of ways to design to work around that element, whatever it might be, that you can't make the problem go away entirely. So you want to go ahead and write up what is your mitigation protocol. How are we addressing that? What was our evaluation of what all the risks were? And here's what we did about it. Again, don't hide that. Don't wait for them to call you out on it and then say, well, here's what we're going to do. Go ahead and put it in there. Be right up front about it and be proactive. Okay, that's risk assessments. We get back to Q&A. I'd be happy to dig into that a lot more, but I think it's important to hit all those elements and do your best to make your job and their job easier and get through the process in as pleasant a way. So now let's have some fun with some slides. Let's talk about some common issues. The pictures on this particular slide are what I define as sometimes my job is really easy. You don't need me to tell you what the hazards are in these pictures. So let's go over some big common issues we run into. Doorknobs. This one. Okay, not okay. Go ahead. I don't want you guys falling asleep. I know it's before lunch, so not okay. What about this one? Yeah, this was the easy slide. It gets harder. How about this one? Okay or not okay? How about this one? So this one's okay and this one's not okay. There's actually not a right answer as to whether they're okay or not okay. It actually has a lot to do with when you installed it. So 5 years ago, these two types of ligature-resistant doorknobs were pretty much the best that existed on the market. And if you put it in at that time, no one can fault you for putting in the state-of-the-art technology, right? In the time since then, patients have found ways to defeat them, and there have been sentinel events associated with both of these doorknob types. And people have invented better ones. So if you put these types of things in today, you're very likely to get cited for it. If you can show that you put it in when it was the latest, they're not going to require that you 5 years later rip it out. There's actually a hospital that I know, a very large hospital. They spent $500,000 putting one of these doorknob types in about a year ago. And after their joint commission survey, they spent another $500,000 replacing them with something else. because even though it was sold as a ligature-resistant product, and my apologies to whoever is doing the door hardware presentation later today, even though it was being sold as a ligature-resistant product, the Joint Commission surveyor did not agree. Yes?
If they did make you change that, would they still make, I'm sure they'd make you still have a mitigation process in place based on that, right?
I would think so. What I got out of that story was I felt really bad for the person who made that decision, because what did that person do wrong, right? They went out and bought a ligature-resistant hardware product, spent a lot of money on it. They didn't think they needed to run it by Joint Commission or hire someone like me to tell them if I thought it was a good product. And yet, I bet they had a very uncomfortable conversation with their boss, right? And that's unfortunate. It's probably not fair. All right. These things just go dead if I don't punch fast enough. There you go. All right. Okay, not okay. Okay, not okay. Yes, on both. These are pretty much in the current industry. These are the best that's out there. Now, if you compare these to these, what have we lost in the name of safety? Yeah. All right. This really is problematic. Usability. These aren't nearly as easy to use. Right, they're not super comfortable. They have passed ADA review standards, so they are compliant. I've gone through lots of these, and I can tell you they're not awesome to walk through, but they're safer, and they're what if you're putting new hardware in. This is the latest. Now, 5 years from now, I'll be back up here talking to you, and these will be a no, because somebody that's the problem with what we do here, right? Every time we invent a new product, the last product becomes essentially obsolete. I think I'm going to run out of time, so let me speed it up a little bit. Door closers, right? It doesn't take a lot of effort to look at this picture and see a ligature risk, right? And yet, if you have a fire-rated door, you have to have a closer. Now, in a brand new facility, the advice I give people is don't ever allow a fire-rated door to bisect a corridor within a unit, because that's a door you're going to want to hold open. If you hold open a fire-rated door, you have an exposed closer. This closer happens to be Joe Bury's favorite closer in the entire world. There's actually a really great story about it. And if we have time at the end, y'all remind me and I'll tell you the story of our favorite closer. But this is exactly that example. It's a smoke barrier door that bisects the unit. The staff need it open to maintain patient safety so they can see the patients down the hallway. But when it's open, you have a ligature risk. It's a fire-rated door, can't take it off. What are you supposed to do? Now, every place else, it can be mitigated. If you've got one of those doors, rooms protected by a self-closing, self-locking door, you make sure that the closer is mounted on the non-patient side. That's pretty easy. If you've got a door that needs a closer that is going to be closed most of the time, use a concealed closer. When the door is closed, you don't have a hazard. I know maintenance-wise, you guys don't love concealed closers. I get that, but in these situations, it's really the thing to do. Toilets. What I found really amusing about this picture was that a surveyor came in and cited them for the exposed pipe, but did not have a problem with the giant gap behind the back of the toilet. I see this a lot, and I'm actually surprised at how often it doesn't get cited, the gap behind the toilet. That is definitely a ligature risk, and it's a ligature risk in the most dangerous place in your entire unit. If you have a private bathroom and a private room for a patient, that bathroom is your highest risk place. That's where we need to be paying most attention, because your chances of something bad happening is there. So we don't want to let anything fall through the cracks when it comes to bathrooms. You can tie something around the back of it, and you place your feet against the toilet, and you'll kick backwards. Yeah. You do not need gravity to hang yourself. Strangulation does not require gravity. There are a lot of other ways to do it. People don't realize that a ligature risk, an attachment point 6 inches off the ground is a ligature risk. We have a tendency to think vertical, but that's...
Since
there's no way to avoid floor drain grates, and I'll jump on it because I don't have a picture of that in here, the general standard is you need to use the really small holes, and the ones I always use have eighth-inch holes, a lot of little eighth-inch holes, because the only thing you can thread through there is a fishing line, and if they have a fishing line, they don't need the floor drain. So... There are some people in the industry who have tried to apply the shoelace approach. If I can get a shoelace through it. But I'm telling you, you cannot weave a shoelace through an eighth-inch hole and back up the other side. Can't be done. So I don't agree the shoelace is the right rule, but even if you do, an eighth-inch hole floor drain is still going to be okay. But there's no consensus in the industry that that's the right answer. That happens to be where most people have gone. And frankly, you can't get water through a hole much smaller than that, so it's kind of as small as you can go. So this is a picture of what ideally we would like this to look like. This is a floor-mounted rear outlet toilet. There's several models like this available in the industry. It is designed to seal tight to the wall, and it even has a real toilet seat, which we now, thanks to our friends at Joint Commission, know is okay. Now, in true fashion, this is in a building that opened 4.5 years ago, and I can already point out several things in this picture that are not okay, that I wouldn't do today. They're okay for that building now, but I wouldn't do them today because new stuff has come out. And by the way, if you do find yourself doing this, please, 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 the flush valve cover needs to be above the grab bar. Otherwise, it's not very useful if you have to take the grab bar off to get to the flush valve. And what that means is the button has to be at ADA height. So even though everybody sells these things with the buttonhole in the middle, it will not work. You have to get a custom drilled plate with the buttonhole below the middle so your button can be at ADA height, but your plate can be above the grab bar. It's a tiny little detail people don't think about, but if you get it wrong, you'll have a really hard time maintaining your facility. This one on the left, I want to point out, this is a great retrofit option. I'm not a big fan of these stainless steel toilets for all the same reasons about HCAP surveys and how many patients really react negatively to stainless steel toilets and the fact that there's not really any evidence that a China toilet is a hazard. But quite frankly, if you're renovating a space, as I did recently for someone in this room, you can't always do this. And so if you need to, do this. It's actually a really good product, meets all the safety. There's several, I'm not endorsing a manufacturer, there's several of these out there that that work well. Okay, let's take another approach to this. Toilet paper holders. I don't have to ask you if this is okay or not. We all agree this is probably not. Here's the interesting part. Are these all okay?
Are you going to talk about that nurse call?
Oh, I wasn't, but... Yeah, if you can have a cord that's like 4 inches or less because you really can't do anything with it. But the problem with this one is there's not a high and a low, and in a bathroom you're required to have a high and a low. Now look, in an inpatient unit bathroom, if you're not med psych, you're not required to have pull station at all, right? You don't have to have nurse call. But if you're going to have it, the only way to safely do it in a psych unit is to have two of them, one high, one low, both with a button. That's no cords. You just got to install two, a high and a low. All right. So out of these four, are they all okay? Is this one good? Okay, not okay? How about this one? How about this one? How about this one? Okay. So here's the interesting point. From a ligature safety standpoint, these are all okay. Here's the problem with this one. This, in case you're wondering, these break away without a whole lot of weight. Okay, so do these tabs. They're meant to break away if you pull too hard on them. They won't hold enough weight for it to be a ligature point. The problem with this one is that because you have to remove the toilet paper roll, take a little off, and put it back, what happens when a patient drops it on the floor? It's contaminated, right? What are you supposed to do with it? Throw it away. Does anyone know that the patient dropped it on the floor? What does the patient do? So what we're seeing is this is getting cited as an infection control risk, right? And so we're seeing a lot of our clients move away. This used to be the answer. I put these in so many facilities, I can't even count. But we've moved away from that because we're seeing a lot of people getting concerned about the infection control risk associated with that. And so that makes some of these potentially a better option. They don't break away completely, they just pull out, and once they're pulled out, they don't hold anything. So the whatever you put on it just slips away. I will tell you, I have not heard of anyone defeating it, but I worry a little bit about this one, although the manufacturer has tested the heck out of it. They swear you cannot hook something on it when it's pulled out. I believe them. It looks a little iffy, but I'm told it works, and it's one of the best at actually holding the toilet paper in, which is actually its primary job. So we shouldn't forget what these things are meant to do. If it doesn't hold the toilet paper in, we're back to this problem, right? If it falls on the floor. Paper towel holders, we have a similar issue. We would, if I could get to the next slide. There we go. There are lots of creative solutions out there for paper towel holders. And in case you're wondering, the biggest problem is not necessarily the top. You can create a slope top. But your typical paper towel holder, if you take a sheet, rob it up, wad it up, and tie a knot, and push the knot up into the bottom part of that paper towel holder, it'll hold you. So the traditional paper towel holder, no good, right? So what a lot of people like to do is the shelf. But much like the toilet paper holder, we have the same problem. If you put a stack of C-folds on there and somebody knocks it on the floor and puts it back, you have an infection control problem, and we tend to get gigged for that. So lots of other great solutions. This one kind of works like the toilet paper holder. This one uses a round roll, so really, really nice design. This takes C-folds and holds them in a stacked position, but it's as simple as it is, it actually works quite well that you really do just get one at a time. And this, which actually weighs about 500 pounds and has to be bolted to blocking, it's incredibly secure. But they have actually taken a traditional style and they have redesigned the way the bottom delivery method works so that you can't shove something up in there. It's a really impressive piece of engineering. I'm not sure you need something that complicated, but if you want to feel really secure about your paper towel holder, that's definitely the one. Grab bars. So this is another infection control issue, right? So what most people have done for a long time is taken the grab bars and added a plate to the bottom, right? So the problem, particularly in a shower, is that they hold water. And what we have seen cited on quite a few surveys is if you drill a hole in it to drain the water, if it's bigger than about an eighth of an inch, it's a ligature risk. And if it's an eighth of an inch, it doesn't drain the water very effectively. And this little spot right back in here where the two meet is almost impossible to clean. So we have an infection control problem. Fortunately, our wonderful people in the manufacturing world have designed some really elegant solutions, so there are better options. So if you have the other ones and you're re-looking at your space and you want to improve your infection control, there are better choices out there now. All right, who can find the safety hazard in this picture? What do we think it is? HVAC grill? Who thinks it's HVAC grill? What else? Who thinks something else?
Is that sprinkler?
Yes, it is.
It's not.
No, it's not. So actually, in a public area, in an observed area, this type of HVAC grill is not necessarily a problem. Okay, it needs to be secured properly. But in observable area, we see those, and they're not terrible. There are better ways to do it. But the real problem here is, if you see this, it's real tempting to think, I don't see a ligature point. But the reality is there's two hazards. Number one, the escutcheon cover, when you pull that off, is weaponizable, so you don't want them to have that. And what's above that is a tamperable sprinkler head, right? So you definitely don't want that. Dion told a wonderful story about what happens when you have water.
That actually happened on the site before, even with a tamper. It wasn't concealed, but with a tamper-resistant head
yeah.
down, the guy had a book, he just smacked it with the book.
Wow. That's what happened. Afterwards, tell me which head it was, because it goes to my next slide, if I could get there. There we go. So fundamentally in the industry, there are basically two institutional-style sprinkler heads. Okay, great. So you just queued up exactly what I was about to tell you. This one over here has been around for a long time. I've been putting them in facilities for over 15 years, so they've been around for more than 20, maybe longer. They have a really good track record, but they have been defeated, right? Dion just told you a story of one. So they're not perfect. They're pretty good. If you've got them, I don't think you necessarily need to replace them, right? On the flip side, this other one over here is much newer. It's been around for about 5 years, so it doesn't have as much track record. It appears to be a superior engineering solution. And so the conversation we have with a lot of owners is, would you rather have the one that might not be perfect but has a long track record with limited problems, or the new one that looks like a better design but hasn't been around long enough for us to tell you with certainty? Some owners pick door number one. Some owners pick door number two. I don't really care as long as they pick one of them and don't put the typical concealed sprinkler head in the space and go, it's concealed, it's fine, Okay? I'm not here to advocate for one over the other. It did, because you had a problem with it. It got defeated. Yeah. Okay. Really? Okay. So for everyone in this room, door number two. Unless you have to publicly bid the project, in which case you might have to put both of them in there and do a preferred brand alternate or whatever it is that you've got to do to get your preferred sprinkler head. Electrical outlets. This is one of my soapbox moments because it's very easy to make electrical outlets safe, and it bothers me when people don't do it because of how dangerous they can be. There are three things you have to do to make an electrical outlet safe, and they're all easy to do. Okay? Number one, make it tamper resistant. Get the little plastic doodads in there that make it hard to tamper with it. That's your first line of defense right there. Number two, you need a protective cover over it that is strong enough and is fastened with tamper-resistant fasteners so the patients can't pull it out and get directly to the wires, right? They don't have to be stainless steel. There are actually some nylon plates that are very thick and very strong and have done very well, okay? So if you don't like the look of the stainless steel plate, you can do that, although I think stainless steel is pretty tried and true, and you can get it painted if you want it. Does anybody know what the third thing is that you need to do with an electrical outlet? Anybody got a guess on what number three is?
Switch outside the room.
That's more of a convenience, but you're still going to turn them on sometime. So that would help because you can turn them off when you're not using them.
It's an
FGI requirement. Okay. But what's the third safety feature? What's the third safety feature? Every outlet that a patient could ever had access to should be connected to a circuit breaker that's ground fault protected. So if they get to it, it pops the circuit. So if they defeat one and two, they're not defeating number three. You're going to pop a circuit. You're going to know what happened. They'll be hurt, but they're not going to be dead. Okay? All three of those are really easy to do, and it drives me crazy when I go in a facility and I don't see those three things done. So check your outlets. So some other solutions. So there's obviously some reference guides you can look at. Don just mentioned the FGI guidelines, which give you some overview of a lot of the requirements you need to do. It doesn't get down into all the specifics. There's the Behavioral Health Design Guide, which for a while was published by FGI, and now is not. Now it's put out by the National Association of Psychiatric Systems, which is now NABS, National Association of Behavioral Health Systems, something like that. It's a consensus standard. A lot of people contribute to it, and therefore it has a lot of great input. The problem with it is it's a consensus standard, which means they can't really offend anybody, so it doesn't tell you clearly yes, no, you should, you shouldn't, this is good, this is bad. It gives you a list of all your options, and it gives you a lot of information about them. But it leaves it to you to make the decision. The one down here on the left is one that's put out by the state of New York, which is not a consensus standard. It's the opinion of the employees of the state of New York. But because they don't have to answer to anybody, it's really clear. Green check means it's okay. Red X means it's not okay. So this creates a real problem in the industry, which is a lot of people want to follow it. It's not meant for you. It's meant for them, right? But what we find is I had a client tell me, well, that's my gold standard. And I said, do you agree with everything in it? She said, oh, I don't agree with everything in it. I just know that if a surveyor comes and he cites me for something and I show him I got it out of that book, the citation goes away. That's fair. We should have a better system than that, but for now, it's not a bad system. So that's a valuable reference. If you're not looking at it, I recommend looking at it. I don't think we should blindly follow it. If you disagree with something in there, I think you should do a full evaluation of your facility and do what you think is best for your patients. Just be prepared to explain why you did it differently. There's also product manufacturers out there. There's some folks who have done a really great job of inventing some great products. They're coming out faster than we can keep track of them. The problem, of course, is there are both good and bad products on the market labeled as ligature-resistant, psych-safe, et cetera. And so a level of evaluation has to be done. And there's a second problem with this, which is all these new products are coming out so fast that if you don't have them, if you don't keep up, you've got to constantly make decisions about, okay, I put that door hardware in 6 years ago and it was state-of-the-art at the time, but now there's something better. At what point am I expected to upgrade my door hardware? I can't be expected to upgrade it every time someone invents a new piece of door hardware, but at some point, someone's going to draw the line and say, you should have upgraded that by now. How do you know when that is? It's a very difficult decision to make to know when that is, and these are expensive decisions in a lot of cases. All right, and then I promise you my duct tape and my magic wand, and we'll wrap up with that. So, duct tape is an amazing thing. You can fix anything with duct tape except a duct. I've always found that deeply ironic. I know the mechanical engineers find it hilarious. The duct tape behavioral health care is security sealant, right? When I go in to check out a place, you can probably fix about 50% of the stuff that I find in most places with some pick-proof caulk, right? So this is an example where we had a sign on a wall, and somebody thought, you know, the top edge of that sign could be a ligature risk. We had a big debate about whether it was or was not a ligature resist, and I said, let's stop talking about it and just caulk around it. Well, now it's not a ligature risk, right? I had one client say, well, I like for the surveyor to find some things. And I said, great, follow behind him with a tube of pick-proof caulk and leave all those things out. You'll be done by the end of the day. Caulk it as they find them. I don't agree with that approach. I think you should try to be as close to perfect as you can, but if that's what you want to do, have your tube ready, right? So that's the duct tape because it's so applicable to so many things. When you see that thing and you scratch your head, fill it with security caulk. The odds are pretty good you can solve it that way. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So it's essentially a sealant that is pick-proof. It creates a hard outer layer. It still has some movement and elasticity, not as much as a typical. So if you're using it in an actual movement joint, you have to check your specs to make sure it'll work. But if you're just caulking around something, that is essentially a hard surface. It's hard to cut it out, and you can't do it with your fingernails. So you can. It's very easy to mold into a slope, like you see on this thing now. I argued you only needed to do the top, but you know, you give somebody a caulk gun and yeah. So that's my one. And the other one that I want to share with you is what I call my magic wand. And it's a magic wand because it's very powerful and very useful and should be used very sparingly. So when all else fails, we go for the magic wand. Joe, you know this picture, right? Yeah. So it's touring Joe's facility, and they have this craft room in their psych facility. And they said, what do you think about this? And I took a deep breath. And I'm sure most people take a deep breath when they walk in there. And they said, well, what we're thinking about doing is taking all of this out and putting in a whole row of lockable cabinets in here so that all that stuff can stay locked behind the cabinet. And I said, so all the hazardous stuff is going to be locked in a cabinet when the patients aren't in the room, and that's our safety feature. Yes. But when the patients are in the room, you're going to take it all out of the cabinet and let them use it. I said, yeah. I said, how do you keep them safe with all these things that they're using? And they said, oh, we know exactly how many we have of everything. And we check every patient as they leave the room, and we do a count on all our supplies beforehand to make sure we've got everything. And I said, that's a great answer. And they've had this for years. It's been working. They haven't had any problems. I said, that's a great answer. Do you have that in writing? They said, no. It's just what we do. I said, well, let's put it in writing, right? When somebody comes to see it, you should have a protocol because they have a really good operational plan. The people running the unit know exactly what they're doing on how to keep patients safe in this space. If having arts and crafts is an important part of your program, don't eliminate the therapy. Think through, because you probably already have, how are we keeping patients safe? Write it down. Train your staff, be prepared to show it to a surveyor, and have a conversation about the lengths that you have gone to make sure that what you're doing is appropriate, okay? So a couple of things about this. Number one, it should be used very, very sparingly. This is your last resort. If there's any other solution, use that first, right? Because, first of all, you don't want to have a whole bunch of these, because not only do you have to show them and, you know, you have to explain why you've solved everything through an operational protocol rather than fixing some things, but number two, you have to train your staff on this. I guarantee you a surveyor is going to pull a random staff person and ask them to explain this protocol to them. And if you have 20 of them that they have to remember, you're not going to pass. So last resort, but you can do it. If you have a legitimate, viable, safe scenario that just doesn't fit what we typically think of as a safe scenario, pull out the magic wand, write up a protocol, interview the staff, make sure everybody's comfortable with it, think it through to make sure there's no flaws in the plan, train your staff on it, and be ready when the surveyor comes. Very dramatic moment. So, if we all take a deep breath, and we remember that these powerful forces are our friends, and that they want the same thing we want, which is safe, treated patients getting the help that they need in a dignified therapeutic environment in which they go home better off than they were when they came in, and we don't really have to shudder quite so much when we hear the names. Thank you. I didn't leave
questions.
A lot of time for
questions.
I didn't leave a lot of time for questions, but
for Kevin.
I did have a question on the toilet seats. Did that not still show a ligature risk with those toilet seats?
So it depends on who you ask.
Yeah.
The Joint Commission, when they did their special report, they found that a lot of people on their committee of experts felt strongly about keeping toilet seats. And so they did a research project on it, and I don't remember the exact numbers, but what they found was that there were, you know, literally like tens of thousands of those seats in place in psych units around the country, and they could find little to no evidence of them being used in the Sentinel events. And so they determined that the experts were right. It was more benefit than harm, and they determined. Now, is CMS bound by that? No, they're not. I mean, I think the research is compelling, but it's Joint Commission's research, so it's not a hard and fast rule, but it's good knowledge. Yes, yes. I have had clients who have been cited for the toilet seat, but what I always tell them is go back to that surveyor, show them the research that the Joint Commission did. And I'm trying to think where it was published. They published it as a white paper. So I'd have to go back and see what the format it was in. But it's available on their Yeah, yeah, it should be. And if not, I can get it for you. I get their perspectives every month, and they wrote it up in that, so I can make that available if you need it. But
I'll tell you one thing that came up. We just had Joint Commission at one of our facilities this week, and we have it's called a dedicated behavioral health room in the ED, like a secluded room, and it has the platform bed with the mattress on it with the little links on the side for the restraints,
and they were going to... Yeah, they were going to cite us for that. And so how we got around that was that was not a dedicated behavioral health room then. It was, you know, different types of patients that would go there at any other given time as well. So that's how we got out of that one.
Yeah, the we didn't really touch on the ED spaces as much today, but a general rule on ED spaces, you know, there's sort of three types that I see. There's a secure holding room, which
right.
is specifically called out for it. FGI and the code, so if you follow that, you can have a secure holding room.
Yeah.
You can have a behavioral health room in which you're basically going to put a patient with a sitter, but it's not going to be locked.
Right.
In theory, if you have a one-to-one sitter in there isn't anything specific you have to do in that room. My recommendation, however, is design it the same way you would with a secure holding room, but it doesn't have to be rated and you don't lock the door.
Right.
I would still recommend the same set of standards. And the third kind, which is very problematic sometimes, is these flex rooms.
Mm-hmm.
And it's problematic because the staff aren't well trained on how to use them.
Exactly.
Where you design an ED room that has the ability to remove a lot of stuff, cover a lot of stuff, and make it a safer room, you still need a sitter.
One-on-one.
You still need one-on-one
yeah.
in that room. It's
yeah.
not ligature safe. It's just
yeah.
ligature. It's just safer.
Yeah.
And staff often don't realize that they can't leave a patient in that room.
And that's the key. It's got to be a flex room to do that. And because if you're dedicating it as behavioral health, it's got to be ligature free.
Because a surveyor is reasonably going to assume that you might leave a patient in there alone because
right.
the staff think it's a dedicated behavioral health room. It's
right.
it's a reasonable assumption for them
yeah,
to make.
Absolutely.
Even if you tell them, no, we would never do that, I mean, you know, so yeah.
So yeah, their suggestion was to change the name of the room.
Fair point.
And we did.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
Got a question. On TVs inside patient areas.
Okay,
got a question. I've been given the task of helping my, as a mechanic at the hospital I'm at, we have a behavioral unit, ED, and also behavioral units. We currently have TV in the day rooms that are mounted.
Mm-hmm.
We're looking at upgrading those TVs to our newer style TVs. And in doing this, we're looking at the ligature problem.
Yeah.
So my question is, in looking at that, we have two options that's been brought to my attention. Is one, mount the TVs on the wall and have a cabinetry maker make a wooden cabinet with plexiglass on it, or go into a commercial vendor like Peerless. This makes a cabinet that is pre-made, but it's more, it's ligature-free, but it's more institutionalized looking. And I noticed earlier you were talking about the environmental that the patients react to, like the stainless steel toilets. Would it be better to put something made by a cabinetry maker that
no
for the patient, or should I be more addressing the ligature problem?
Here's my suggestion. I have seen a lot of those custom-made cabinets that, despite the best intentions of everybody involved, I can find ligature points on it, and so can a surveyor. I think that's a dangerous route. My approach is the ones that are commercially available, there are some that look very nice. They're simple. Usually they're just black, but you can get them in other colors. They're very simple. They're very effective. Even look at some of those, because there are some that are sold as that I don't think are nearly as good as some of the other ones. What we have done in the past to make those look nicer is you build up a piece of millwork that contains your, you know, it has some locked cabinets, it has your equipment in it and whatnot, and maybe you bring up a nice wood wall that goes up the wall, and then you mount the TV with all the wires behind that, use it as a wire chase, mount the TV on it, and then put the cover over that. The result of the whole thing is actually quite nice, and it's much safer than building it yourself and taking the risk that you'll have spent that money and you'll still have... It's just your cabinet maker's not an expert at that, and it's a lot to ask, because the devil's in the details for sure. Anybody else?
There's been some discussion about, let's say, beds and ED holding units, mm-hmm. Whether you should use, you know, your opinion about beds mounted to the platform, beds mounted to the floor, weighted beds. What is your experience with beds and
well,
clearances around them?
Sure. In an ED space, my general recommendation would be they should be bolted, right? They should be fixed. Certainly, we have a client we've worked for that had a treatment program built around user choice, and they didn't want the beds fixed. In fact, the first thing they encourage patients to do when they arrive is to rearrange the furniture. But they have an entire operational program built around that being how they do things, and they've thought it through, right? And I asked them a million questions about this because I was concerned about it. That's not going to be the case in an ED where people are in crisis. In my mind, the best thing to do with that bed is to have it be fixed. Okay?
More of the question is in like secure holding rooms, which are much smaller than a behavioral
right.
Exam room. They're usually, you know, FGI talks about 60 square feet. Well, if you have 60 square feet for a holding room or 80 square feet for a seclusion room or whatever,
yeah.
A bed doesn't allow for much clearances around it, a platform bed.
Yeah.
And if you bolt it down, you sort of are intruding some of the clearances that are required for the room to function.
Right. So... the answer to that sort of varies by state, but unless somebody corrects me, Don, in North Carolina, I don't believe in a secure holding room. We are required to have certain clearances around the bed, and my recommendation is always to put them in the corner because it avoids any kind of a hiding spot. I don't think there's a reason you need access to both sides of a platform bed that has a behavioral health patient on it, because you're not providing medical interventions in that space. If you're going to, you need to move them to another space anyway. There are other states which specifically have state rules that require you provide clearance all around. They make no exceptions for psych beds. And there, it's a harder challenge. Frankly, the rooms just end up bigger. But I don't believe that we have that requirement here. So my recommendation is the safest and best thing to do is to put them in the corner. That uses the least amount of space, and it also is the most comfortable for the patient, who very often if you go in there, what you'll see is they turn towards the wall. Remember, as much as we're worried about managing the symptomatic issues that the patient has, which often are violent in nature, that patient is experiencing extreme fear. And when you get them isolated in that room, what they're going to do more often than not, if they're not being violent, is curl up in a ball and face the wall. And they're really going to be happier if they have a wall. So I think there's a lot of therapeutic value to doing that as well. So unless the regulations prevent you from doing that, my recommendation is always to put it in a corner.
So unless someone tells me different, Don, I love that. That was good. So focus on the mission. The mission being taking care of those who can't take care of themselves, creating a safe environment. And that's what this is about, creating the safe environment for patients that have mental illness. We got to do that. Kevin, I thought that was a phenomenal presentation. It was the education we needed. Hand again for Kevin.
You're welcome.
So all of this, the regulatory compliance, is the gold standard for how we take care of our environment. That's what this is. And they're just doing their job, trying to figure out how to create the best, safest environment for all the patient types we have. So thank Kevin for what was great 5 years ago, and there's something better today. Thank goodness there's something better today. We'll get there eventually. Last presentation before we break for lunch, and that's going to be, what did I do with my notepad? I don't know what I did. Here we go. We're talking about ASHRAE. We got Terry Fair and Joe Burry. We're going to talk about ASHRAE Advocacy Report and sustainability. Michael Roberts was supposed to be a part of this to give us a Region 3 update, but he's called back to the mothership and won't be able to do that. So do you have lavaliers? Do you want a hand mic? You want the podium? You want that?
Yeah.
Okay, that's good.
Okay, good afternoon. So it looks like Joe and I are the last things between you and lunch, so we'll try to make this brief. So, I've been doing the ASHE advocacy liaison for the last few years, and Joe is new to the Energy to Care program. And so they've recently combined these calls. We have quarterly calls, which, again, is part of our affiliation process with ASHE, and that's how we get our platinum elite level. So we have to be on these quarterly calls every 3 months. So anyway, push the slide forward. So I'm going to give you an NFPA update, ASHRAE update, FGI, USP, ICC.
It's working.
Oh, it's working. Okay. And then well, I'll show when our next webinars are going to be at. So
which one goes forward?
Okay, NFPA. All right, so the new versions of 99 and 101 are currently in the second draft. There were, for 99, there were 152 proposed changes. 48 of those were rejected. And then in 101, there was 146 proposed changes, which 59 were rejected. And so the rejected piece of it just means it's got to go back down to the floor for more discussion and before, you know, the final vote will happen on that. And the NIPMAM date, closing date, was February the 19th, and then the posting date will be on April the 1st. And I had to write down notice of intent to make a motion. So that's kind of the deadline for that. Okay, some of the proposed changes, this one here, again, we just had a Joint Commission survey this week. RPTs was a big topic again. And so NFPA is doing a better job now of giving us better definition. You know, one of the big things, and we've looked at all of our facilities, is what does permanently mounted mean? And this gives you a better definition of it. So, you know, the folks that are looking for that information, it's going to be right there in front of them. So, again, you can't use like the zip ties and tape and that type of thing. It's got to be something that is physically mounted that you would need a tool or something to remove it. So again, it's in this code. It's going to be in the code now. So that's a good thing. And then this one here, I know a lot of, we've done a lot of this over the years, is where, you know, your bed census is down, and you've taken some rooms, and you may have converted them to some offices or something, and you've got med gases in there. They're getting a little more specific about how you decommission and utilize those rooms in that way. I know typically in the past, over the years, you know, you'd make a box or something, just put it over the wall and hide those outlets so somebody could move their office in there. Again, they're getting more specific and giving you more guidelines to do that with. Okay, this one here is just talking about your risk categories and your utilities equipment and how you know how you're designing those. You know, you can design, you know, like if you got a category 2 or 3 area and you want to put a category 1 system in there, you're allowed to do that because at some point you may want to bring it up to that level as well. So they've put some language in here that talks about that you can do that. And this, again, still talks about the risk categories. It shall be permitted to serve spaces identified as a Category 1, 2, or 3. A Category 1 system could do that. Okay, this one's another good one, and it typically comes up in a lot of Joint Commission surveys. You have the surveyors score you on block zone valves and those types of things. Again, it gives you a little more clearer definition in regards to that what that is now, and I think it's going to give us a little more leeway. Like, you know, a lot of times if you had a cart in front of a zone valve that you could still walk up to, it's still in your line of sight and you could still operate it, you would still get scored. But now it's giving you a little bit more leeway on there, and the definition there hopefully will help us in some more surveys as you go forward. This one just talks about full and empty cylinder. The maximum temperatures going to be at 125 degrees Fahrenheit now and 52 Celsius. Shouldn't exceed those. Okay, this is the existing medical gas signage on your doors. They're giving you specifics now and what it should be labeled at, and they got it clear in the code now. Medical gases, no smoking or open flame. Exit signs. So a lot of discussion around exit signs. You know, why are we spending and wasting a lot of time walking around looking at exit signs every month? You know, typically, you know, if you've got battery-powered exit lights, that's a different story. But if you got one tied to your emergency power system, your generator system, you know, why are we going around and looking at these, you know, monthly and wasting a lot of time? You know, a lot of them nowadays are all LEDs. You know, those things very seldom go out. So that's one thing the ASHI advocacy is working on, is trying to do this as an evidence-based testing now to potentially maybe go to a quarterly or something like that. When they do try to come out with that, they're going to be wanting to, you know, get some information, you know, some people to, you know, give you your numerators and denominators and what your failure rate is. So that would be something that we would ask for some public comments at some point. Required fire doors. So this one is going to be a good one for the industry now. You know, if you had on your life safety plans, you had a wall that was derated, and you still had a fire door in there that had a label on your frame and a label on your door, they're saying now that you don't have to maintain that door anymore. And it spells that out in this one, in NFP 80. Fire alarm exception on the third shift. Again, it just talks about, you know, what the exceptions are. You know, you don't have to sound the horns. I know we run into this a lot. You know, I actually had a hospital CEO just absolutely refused to do a third shift fire drill, and we talked him down off the ledge on this one, you know, to explain to him how, you know, how we do that. But again, it clearly identifies a little bit better for him. Soiled linen and trash receptacles. This one, I know this came up in our survey again this week. So the soiled linen and the trash collecting receptacles, typically that were over 64 gallon. Now it says with the capacities greater than 64 gallon shall be located in hazardous areas when not attended. And again, that did come up on our survey. We actually had what happened is our kitchen area is it had a complete two-hour rating around it. We had some containers larger than 64 gallons in it, but the problem was the life safety plans did not have it hashed out as a hazardous area. So be careful with that one. And then the campaign for 2020, so we anticipate the issues for the health care for the 2021 edition. They'll be sharing these with the ALs and as they develop. And then we need ASHI members to attend for the vote. You know, we're losing some of these votes, like three or four votes. So we need ASHI members to attend and vote for these proposed changes in there. And that's going to be coming up at the conference in the 15th of June. 15th through the 18th in Orlando. So if you can get there and you have voting privileges, make sure your membership is up to date, get down there and vote. So we're anticipating we'd love to have about 300 people down there at that vote. Okay, this is another one that we're going to be asking for public comments on. It's for monthly fire extinguisher inspections. Again, you know, we're walking around, spend a lot of time every month looking at these extinguishers. They're proposing that we potentially go to a quarterly fire extinguisher inspection. Again, we're going to need some ammunition when we go to do this. We're going to need your numerators and denominators. So if you've got a way to track that and give us your failure rates, then that could help us get that pushed through. Again, your fire, the inspections, trying to reduce the frequency. The inputs were rejected, so anyway, the public comment's going to be open till May the 6th, or it closes May the 6th, so we're going to start soliciting that information to run it back through again. Okay, quick ASHRAE. ASHRAE 170 ventilation for the healthcare facilities. They're working on several data and formal interpretations, and it will be formally issued via ASHRAE. The 189.3 design and construction and operational standards, sustainability, high performance of healthcare, and that was finalized with the 189.1. And 100 met with the committee chair and the committees to discuss the action plan for improving energy use targets. Not a lot going on with that right now, but that was in the winter meetings. And then there's currently no open addenda for the public comments right now, so that hopefully some more of those will be coming soon as they meet and get more information. FGI, so we have a in-person meeting once a year, so we went to Denver this year and we sat and we actually divided up all the NFPA chapters, and so I'm actually sitting with the FGI for healthcare and the FGI for ambulatory, as well as NFPA 70. They for the FGI changes, there was like 1,500 proposed changes for FGI. They gave me 150 of them to go through, and you know, you either go through, you read through them, either accept them, reject them with comments, or just totally reject them. And, you know, I approved a lot of them, but there were several of them that, you know, I was kind of on the fence with. So by rejecting it, it actually takes it back to the floor for more discussion, so, you know, which is a good thing. We turned those into the committee. It was scheduled for March the 31st. Through April the 3rd, so they're actually, that was about a week ago. Don't know the outcome of that right now, but the manuscript will be finalized, and a comment period will be open for public beginning in June the 1st, so you'll start seeing what changes they're proposing to put in those FGI guidelines. USP appeals panel met, waiting on determination. Denied appeals resulting in the standards approved by the excerpt committee become official. grant one or more of the appeals resulting in a remand of the standards to the responsible expert committee for further evaluation. Again, all these proposals and stuff, people, you know, make comments and things, but it's still got to go back to the final committee for to get the proposed changes made. And the Joint Commission, obviously, they're involved with it. The USP 797, again, that came up in our survey this week. You either have to be using one or the other. You can't be using both of the both 797 and 800. So you have to choose which one you're going to use and go with it. International Code Council, there's really nothing going on with it right now. They're going to be meeting to prepare the 2024 cycle. That meeting will be March the 24th, 25th, and 26th, and it was going to be at the ASHI PDC, which got canceled. So now we don't know when that's going to happen. And then open to public comment and interest. And then our next webinar dates, quarter two will be in May. Three will be our liaison day. I think we're going to Chicago this year. And then December the 9th. So, again, all the webinars we have to be on to keep our affiliation with ASHI. So Joe and I get on those calls and meet a lot of people. All right. I'm going to turn it over to Joe.
I guess good morning yet. So Joe Burry. I'm a Director of Facility Services at Southeastern Health and also the ASHI Energy Liaison. Well, anyway, I'll get started a little bit. healthcare is always getting hit with things, more to do, although we did hear a few things about maybe cutting back on fire extinguishers, which would be a very nice thing, as well as the exit lights. Seems like we don't have a lot of failure rates with those. But there is some word going out, and in fact, mentioned on ASHRAE 170, that they're looking to instill some penalties for energy use. So I have some of the numbers up here, but essentially Washington State has adopted it already. And what they're doing is a $50,000, make sure I say that correct, no, $5,000 fine plus $1 a square foot. And that would be imposed every year if you don't meet certain energy guidelines. So some of those right now, if I can, we'll get there. The numbers that they're working on for an energy usage index are quite low. I think they're about 143 kBTUs, which is a relatively very low number. So just some of the things I'm going to cover. Let me talk about the energy targets. So this is what came out from ASHI, but I'll just kind of highlight some of that. So State of Washington passed legislation, 5,000 plus. Now, there is a workaround to that, but there's also pieces that go along with that. One of those items is to do a level two energy audit. So with that, it'll identify some savings in your return on investments, which is a good thing. You can see if it's something that you can make your money back in a year, 2 years, whatever that may be, and some much further. But you would need to start implementing that. And some of the language on all that and where that's going, is, my guess, is still a ways out. So anyway, that's I wanted to kind of show some of the numbers here. Okay, so currently, the median hospital inpatient energy usage index target is 139. I said 143, so it's much lower than that. So when we look at the portfolio manager, for those that are using that, the number in there is at 243. So if the 139 is going to be the target, we've got a lot of work to do. Otherwise, there's going to be a lot of penalties. So in energy to care, right now, that some of the top performers are at 163. Just kind of give you an idea of numbers. So those are absolutely great numbers. So those are folks with energy star numbers in the 90s. So that is very nice. So with this, ASHI is launching a workshop, and what they're trying to do is get more people involved in putting their data into energy care so we can actually have some better numbers to compare and then not penalize hospitals down the road with some additional work and fines and things like that. I was asked a little bit before about how much work is involved in all this and is it worth it to me. So anyway, in a sense, that's one of the items that we as facilities as an expense unit that can actually control and put something back. If you're lucky enough to have a 2% bottom line, for every dollar you save, that's worth $50 of revenue that the organization doesn't need to find. So it's there's some things that we can do and impact into the bottom line, more than just cutting costs. It's also what we can do where we can cut costs, improve our environment, and save some money. So I'll talk a little bit about the workshops. So again, trying to get the data in. The workshops will make it pretty painless for to do. You can download the data and probably spend more time looking at the data and the reports that come out of it that are quite interesting. So I'll be working with our chapter to see what we can do, and we're talking about maybe doing something at the annual or at some of the district meetings to kind of make it a little easier for people and walk them through it. So energydecare.org dashboard is kind of a step-by-step video process and how to do it. Very simple. So back to the workshop. So they're having several of them. I would like to do the two-hour one, which actually will show you how to download your data and actually walk you through that whole process and then show how easy it is and then look at some of the reports. So the one-hour training, which is going to be free, so anybody can request that. So it's just understanding what it is, how to set up your building and your organization if you have multiple buildings. The two-hour goes a little bit deeper, and like I said, shows you about uploading your utility data in the dashboard. So, and then the interpretation of the data and the performance of the buildings. And then what that'll do is it'll normalize all your information and see where you stand with other hospitals. It makes a nice selling tool for all the administrative team, the C-suites. And then the four-hour course gets into a little more of the reporting functions and some Q&A with them. So with that, this is what Energy to Care dashboard looks like. So this actually here is my facility. So as you can see, it shows you how much money we've saved, what our cost is, and of course what our KBTUs are. So just kind of give you some more. There's all kinds of information. You can click on these rings and this these data squares, and more information will provide. So, and you also get a nice chart, and again, these are all interactive. So you can look at what your usage is and how much you're spending and kind of give you a graphical picture of that. They even have a setup that you can get monthly updates of your data. ASHI also has Energy University. These are also CE credits as well. A wealth of information for all types of people, whether you're designers or facility managers or energy managers. Talk about their one-hour one that they're offering for $0, something maybe one of the districts may want to tackle that. Okay, talk a little bit about the awards. So we have two kinds of awards, and we have seven facilities here in North Carolina that had received the award in 2019. The deadline is actually December. We have to April 1st to get the data in. So those who are part of the program now, we need to make sure you get your data in. There we go. So, of course, an awards are somebody with 10% in a single year or 15 over 2 years. And then beyond that, 5%. So it sounds like a lot, but translates into a lot of money. And the other piece to this is they use the source data and not the site data. Now, the source data is the amount of energy that's coming from your power supplier. So whether it's Duke or whatever that is. So, and on the site, it'll separate that out. You can see your site data as well as your source data. I said the other piece to that really gets into some talking about the performance metrics of it, and that's really learning about the data and what it all means. So going forward, they're going to be changing the dates. But as I mentioned, for this year, the close of 2019, December, and we got to April 1st to get it all in. And these are the 29 facilities in North Carolina currently that are part of the Energy to Care Chapter Challenge. Right now, we're getting slow out of the blocks. And here are our 2019 recipients. So very congratulations to all those facilities. We hope to do better. 2019, the winners for the small category were New England Healthcare Engineers, and for the large was California Society for Healthcare Engineering. Okay, so out of this, 527 facilities, 17 chapters, and of course we're one into the large category. And let me show right here. You can see, I've kind of got it highlighted there, that we're right now a reduction of about 1%, so we've got a little bit of ways to go. Next year, the reporting data will be from April 1st to March 31st. So it's going to be a little bit of difference, and again, they'll be looking at the 12-month period. And the treasure hunt, which was part of the CDC, has been, as we all know, has been canceled. So, excuse me?
Sadness, no treasure hunt.
Yeah. So, anyway, with that, if there's any questions, and if not, I guess Dion's going to let us go to lunch.
Thank you. Thank you, Joe and Terry. There's a lot of interesting stuff, Terry, on the regulatory side. Jerry Shepard, hope you took some good notes. I'm liking some of those. This is what your lunch ticket looks like. You'll need one of those to get lunch. I wish I had a picture on the slide, but there's a NCHEA app that you can download. Just go to the App Store and get that. All these presentations, the bios on the speakers, a lot of the PowerPoints are all there already, and if they're not there now, they will be there soon. We have, following lunch, we have a USP 800 and door hardware, a couple of sessions of those following up. We're a little bit ahead of schedule, no problem. We're just going to come back, plan on being back at 1:30 to kick off those education sessions. Are there any questions for anybody on the floor? If not, enjoy your lunch.